Okay, so 2016 is current. That's where we're at the moment. And the initial thought is to look at the the issues, the principles, the questions, and whatnot of the three previous time period episodes, event type of occasions that we looked at, and see what we have for applicability today in our current setting and environment and all that sort of thing. So when I look at 1844, the thing that stands out to my mind, and you know, other people may see things differently, of course, but the thing that stands out most to my mind is that the believers in the Advent message of 1844, the Millerites, those who thrived, if you wish, those who spiritually prospered, seem, from the accounts, to be those who ran what you would call, I suppose you could say, just greater risks. Those who were willing and able to step out and actually depend on God more. Let's put it that way, okay? So what I'd like to just, you know, to me, something that I personally think is important is that our young people need to be constantly surrounded with the reality that Christianity is not a done deal. You know, it just irks me no end when I pick up this sense from kids that, you know, well, yeah, it's just what it is. You know, we go to church and then we do nothing and then we go to church again next week, you know. And there's no sense of calling, no sense of adventure, in a sense, no sense of risk, no sense of commitment, no sense of, you know, and we've got to get away from that. Our young people need to see that, you know, Christianity, Adventism, is an ongoing, vibrant thing that I guess how can I put it? In order to really be that, I think it needs to involve miracles on a regular basis, not necessarily big miraculous miracles type of parting of the Red Sea type of thing, but we need to engineer opportunities and circumstances in which our youth can see God working on a frequent basis in their own lives and in their own involvements. So you get some of that in things like some of the summer call putter programs. Some of those are really good, you know. But I think there's a lot more that we can do in that regard. Anything that can be done to integrate that sort of an activity into a school educational system, I think is marvelous. And I would just kind of encourage that idea. What did 1844 do for us? You know, that's an interesting question because some people, they have the Adventist doctrine of the 2300 days, sanctuary, and all that sort of thing has at times been attacked as being a figment of someone's imagination that makes no difference in the life. You know, I mean, you can paint it that way easily. So how much difference is there in your daily life because Jesus is in one apartment of the sanctuary as opposed to the other apartment of the sanctuary? Does that change anything? You know? And so people have ridiculed and attacked the sanctuary doctrine. I think that's very short-sighted. I'll agree to a certain amount that the actual salvation process that an individual might personally experience, I couldn't point to it and say, the whole system changed because Jesus went into the most holy place, as far as the day-to-day experience of the individual. But the mindset changed, and that changes the experience of the individual. Adventism at that point launched itself, or the Lord launched Adventism off onto a trajectory that knows no end other than the second coming. You follow what I'm saying? We don't, the sanctuary doctrine, the whole investigative judgment, the whole idea of that judicial preparation for the second coming, all of that should, in our minds, establish this just whole mindset that says that's where we're going. We know where we're going. That's the only direction to head, and that's just the way it is. So I would just offer that thought on 1844. There are lots of little doctrinal things that I don't know that I'm going to try and get into at this point. Understanding of the process, the investigative judgment, and all that sort of thing. Question? Comment? Yeah. Yes. There are lots of things that the whole concept of the investigative judgment, of course, is based off of the books of record, and I don't see the judgment of the living based that way. The judgment of the living is based off of a real time test. It's much more like Noah's Ark type of thing. The question boiled down to a single issue: which side of the door are you on? And that was not something that you needed a book of record to decide, you know. Same thing with Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, are you in town or out of town? The Lord has this way of boiling things down. There's actually a fascinating statement talking about Adam and Eve. It acknowledges that they had other duties, but that all of their spiritual experience was, forget the exact wording, but was bound up in a single question about that single tree. You know, we could imagine that they could have disobeyed in other ways. You know, they were told to tend and keep the garden, and they might have said, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go on strike." You know, so that would, you know, we could come up with ways that they might have disobeyed. But it was that one question, that one single question, and so that's the way I see the judgment of the living coming down to is the final question. In the context of the true and false Sabbath, of course, but you know, the final question is, do you have faith? Do you have faith? And the investigative judgment shows us the quality that's to be examined or to be tested. So, yeah, there's all sorts of things. It's a little hard, I suppose, without sitting down and writing some sort of a thesis on the point to accurately describe all those things, but there's a lot of mental conditioning that comes out of that doctrine. it also, of course, everything coming out of there, we have, that was the occasion that established our basic pillars, you know, the the five S's, Sabbath, Sanctuary, State of the Dead, Second Coming, and Spirit of Prophecy, and somebody has seven S's. What are the other two? Do you remember? Somebody came up with something, some way to add a couple of other creative things. Can't remember what they are, but those five all came directly from that Millerite movement. And so in that way, that's a part of the legacy. But in terms of our own experience, I would say perhaps the biggest thing that I think the importance of is that thread, that fuse, if you wish, that I think was the big issue at the time, and I think it remains the big issue, and that is, you know, are we able and willing to look to some other defining authority than what's around us? You know, when Miller stopped being a nice little farmer and started being a preacher, that was the end of certain aspects of his life. You know, when Himes stepped out from being the socialite pastor to being a crusading Millerite preacher, you know, those are the kind of changes that are going to, you know, we're going to have to be willing to make. We have to be ready to make. Spirit Prophecy, you know, speaks that often of the, you know, the if we have, how's that wording go? You know, those who have sided with the world on this, this, and this, you know, well, at the final test, find it the easiest thing to do is just to carry along with the world. So there are questions there that frankly I think we should be looking at now and saying, you know, at what do I do at this stage in my life, you know, at this stage in world events, where do I go from here? How do I prepare myself for what's coming down the pike? Had an interesting experience just I guess it was Monday morning this last week. I was coming home. I'd been teaching for a week at AFCO Europe over in Portugal. And the union health director had heard that I was there, and he wanted to meet with me briefly. So we met 7:30 in the morning at the airport before I got on the plane. Very nice fellow, Daniel, and I'm sorry I've forgotten his last name entirely, but I probably would mispronounce it anyhow. But but he was telling me an interesting story. He said, he had been sharing with, he was the health director and been sharing with the pastors. There are 60 pastors in Portugal. He'd been sharing with them, and he'd shared that quote, where Ellen White says, "Soon there will be no ministerial work done but medical missionary work." And he shared that, and there was someone had made a comment which wasn't, I don't remember what the wording was. It wasn't blatantly disrespectful or anything like that, but it tended to minimize the probability of that happening anytime soon. Let's put it that way. And he said, he just suddenly realized and thought of it, and he said, "So what would you be doing now if you were in Russia?" You know, because last May, I think it was, they outlawed all proselyting. Right? You cannot speak of religious things outside of a religious meeting. You can't invite someone to a religious meeting. You can't do anything. So how are you going to win souls? You know, and Spirit Prophecy has said over and over again that, you know, medical missionary work is the door that through which the truth will find entrance into our large cities. Medical missionary work is the closing up work. It's the full representation of the ministry of Christ. Christ-like ministry for the body combined with Christ-like ministry for the soul is the true interpretation of the gospel. It was all those statements. And so those things are all coming. And it would be nice, maybe. I'm sure it would be inviting to have this nice little roadmap telling us every event, you know, and so, oh yeah, so well, next Tuesday this is going to happen, and, you know, da-da-da-da, you know. But we live in very volatile times, and you know, I can't tell you what's going to happen, you know. I mean, it's interesting watching U.S. politics from safely up in Canada at the moment. there was actually a one of these little things that they post on Facebook. You know, it was kind of cute. It showed a picture like out somebody's living room window in suburbia, right? So you're looking out someone's living room window, and on the front lawn out there was this nice little, you know, 18-inch inflatable swimming pool thingy, you know, 8-foot diameter. And there's a mother moose, cow moose, lying there on the lawn, and two little baby mooses. I don't know what they call them, calves, I guess, probably, anyhow, whatever they are, and, lying there, and they're all just sitting there, all looking very peaceful. And across, just across the road on the other side in front of the other house, is this car that's just going up in flames. And the caption said, "What it's like watching U.S. politics from Canada these days." but we are in a very volatile world. And so, I commend to you frequent consideration in your own mind, in your own heart, in your own prayer life, what your circumstances dictate as being prudent. Let's put it that way, you know. If you want to get more involved in, let's put it this way, if you want to be more involved in the Lord's work at the end of time, I suggest starting to get more involved now. Find some way. Find some way. There's ways out there. Anyhow, okay, well, let's jump ahead to 1888 once. You know, maybe you don't all know, but if you've followed or if you've been involved in that whole discussion, the whole 1888 perplexity, let's put it that way. Largely, it was, I mentioned before today, Robert Wieland and Donald Short. They're the ones who put 1888 back on the map in the 1950s with their manuscript, 1888 Reexamined. It had almost been completely forgotten, to be honest. They're the ones who put it back on the map, and they began earnestly trying to find, how do we reignite the loud cry? How do we restart this thing? And so that debate continues to this very day. I believe that it's unfortunate that we are primarily still engaged solely in a matter of trying to find a theological solution to that. It's very difficult because Adventism fits like a jigsaw puzzle. And, it's one thing I have to say for Robert Wieland, and Donald Short, they were not renegades in any bad sense of the term, anyhow. They were not going to go throwing Adventist doctrine away. They weren't going to go throwing the church away. They didn't do any of those things. But they were dedicated to trying to find some additional piece from Jones and Wagner, some theological influence that would fire up the loud cry again. And they tried a number of different formulations, right? Don't worry about this if you haven't followed that debate and discussion, but the first thing was corporate repentance, and no one could really define what that would be anyhow in the first place. That was kind of fuzzy. And then they've gone through a variety of different forensic justification, and easier to be saved than it is to be lost, and I don't remember all the others along the way. But it's really hard to squeeze something into this jigsaw puzzle without shoving some pieces around. And so, to my mind, when I ran across Kellogg's document in which he, for the first time, I'd never heard that suggestion from any other source, he just simply said, basically, that the loud cry is dependent on Isaiah 58. He just asserted it almost. But, once I had that idea in my mind, the evidence for it in the spirit of prophecy is just piles upon piles. It's like, I had a friend on a different topic once, I asked him, can you find any evidence for it? And his response to me was, can you find any water in the ocean? And that's the way it's become almost. Everything I see and I read, you can just see. I mean, it just jumps out at you that that the Lord's plan is for his people to manifest his character. And the only way we can do that is actually do the kind of work that he did. It's become such a simple thought to me that it's hard to be amazed by it anymore. But it was so amazing the first time I read it. I don't know why, but I just had never gotten to that. So I think that 1888 is still very much a big part of the thing. I would argue that, yes, the loud cry had just barely begun, because Adventists had just barely begun active, hands-on ministry to the world around them. If I were going to point to a disappointing feature of the original 1888 message enthusiasm, it would simply be that the vast majority of the discussion never moved beyond what do I do to be saved? How are my sins forgiven? Well, that's important. Nothing wrong with exploring that aspect. But, you know, there's justification by faith. There's righteousness by faith, which, to my mind at least, moves like, you know, justification is almost solely my own salvation. Righteousness includes right doing and moves beyond, you know. What about all the other things by faith? You know, everything that God's people are called to do, whatsoever is not of faith is sin, says, you know. So what about operating schools by faith? What about, you know, evangelism by faith? What about all these other things that we're supposed to be doing? You know, how does faith fit into that? I think, frankly, that Kellogg and the medical missionary workers back then deserve a portion of the credit for adding their piece to the puzzle that I believe started the loud cry. Jones and Wagner were excellent on the matchless charms of Christ, and by that, I would move that a little bit out of the fuzzy emotional aspect, you know, matchless charms. It's more of a feminine construction. You know, coming from a guy's perspective, I would look at it and I'd say, he can do stuff nobody else can do. You know, and that's pretty cool. You know, Christ can do stuff that nobody else can do, like take care of me, for instance. You know, that's. I just think that this matchless charms of Christ thing extends to a lot of areas where we've not traditionally seen it. And so I would commend that idea to your thinking. probably we skirted around one of the areas that I think is one of the biggest applications for today. And it's unfortunate, it's unpleasant. I wish that it didn't exist. But it does, and I cannot deny or ignore it. I don't like to spend a whale of a lot of time dealing with it, but and that would be that, you know, Kellogg, like I said, he started off quite well from 88 to, I would say, basically about 1896. You just start to see the tenor of his attitude changing then. Following that, and especially, you know, a couple years later when he had some antagonistic run-ins with General Conference personnel and this sort of thing, he just became hardened, and he just became more and more determined that he was going to make a name for himself by his own great works, you know. And Ellen White refers him to the example of Nebuchadnezzar, you know, because he was down in Chicago building up this great Chicago mission, which I have built, you know, and she likens that to Nebuchadnezzar, who was pretty pumped up on Babylon one day, as you may recall. But Kellogg eventually transitioned wholly over to what I refer to now, just for simplicity's sake. I split his influence into the good Kellogg and the bad Kellogg. And the good Kellogg was the medical missionary work. The bad Kellogg started off with bitterness towards individuals and the General Conference kind of as a whole, and deteriorated in ways that we do not fully know. down into really interesting statements. I wonder if I could find those quickly. I don't know. Ellen White makes a lot of statements to Kellogg in letters written to him about, and also written to some others about him, of a very direct connection with Satan. I don't get the impression that he was a Satanist or a Luciferian or anything like that in a knowing sense. But Ellen White often says that the devil had such a hold on his mind that he did not know what he himself was saying and doing. She says that when he wrote the book Living Temple, the one who deceived Adam and Eve stood by his side and assisted him with that book. Well, that's not a real good recommendation by any stretch. Eventually, of course, Ellen White used the enigmatic phraseology of the Alpha of apostasy and the Omega of apostasy. Kellogg, she said that the Alpha was contained in the book Living Temple. So that would direct our thoughts to pantheism. Okay, it's you can't contain a physical object so well into a book. You contain philosophical ideas and theories and things like that. So pantheism is what we've always identified as being the Alpha of apostasy. Ellen White makes quite a few comments about the Alpha. She only makes about four comments about the Omega of apostasy. Now, just by way of clarification, Alpha and Omega are the first and the last letters of the Greek alphabet. It would be like R, A, and Z. And Jesus, you know, is quoted that way in Revelation. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the ending, you know, first and last. And so she uses that terminology and that phraseology there, talking about this apostasy, the Alpha of apostasy in Kellogg's day and the Omega of apostasy, which she does not directly date. But the implication of the Omega aspect has always seemed to indicate at the very end of time. Okay, it's the last one. She says that the Omega apostasy would be startling. She said that she trembled for our people. It was a fearsome enough thing. The only thing that she said with any real direct specific content, she said that the Omega of apostasy would be received by those who refuse to take heed to the warning that was given. I don't think that's the exact wording, but it's pretty close. And so that's an interesting question. What is the warning that has been given? The Omega will be received by those who refuse to benefit from that warning. She doesn't say. She doesn't say. And so I went looking for warnings. And there are some general things, but there's only one that comes up repeatedly in a very specific sense. And that, what I, my best estimate at this point, anyhow, the warning that hinges, I mean, our whether we will receive the Omega when it comes or not hinges on this one thing. There may be other things that would predispose us to accepting it as well, but the one thing that she consistently warns about is to stay away from that sort of material. She specifically says, don't read Living Temple. Don't read other books like that. Okay, that's why I said earlier today, no, I haven't read Living Temple. I don't recommend that that you do. but you have to grasp how repugnant that is to the intellectual world. You know, we've built this whole academic model in our minds where knowledge is always good, you know. And along comes some little lady 100 years ago, and she says, that's knowledge that you shouldn't have. Don't read it. And, you know, the obvious parallel to the knowledge of good and evil in a tree, I think, is pertinent. And the scary thing is that there are a lot of people who are dabbling in that sort of thing and clearly reading those kind of books. And that's scary. That's just not a good thing at all. There was an interesting, there's an interesting letter written by Arthur White in 1972 in response to an inquiry from Elder Robert H. Pearson. Anybody remember Elder Pearson? He was the General Conference president back in those days. He was a good man from all I have ever heard, seen, or picked up. Apparently, Elder Pearson wrote to Elder White, who was the secretary of the Ellen G. White estate, and asked about the Omega of Apostasy. Now, I find that fascinating, that you know the General Conference president would take this seriously enough. I think it was commendable, you know, to write and say, you know, we've been warned that there's something coming. I'm in a fairly responsible position here. Perhaps I should know a little bit more about this. You know, is there anything more you can tell me? And so Arthur White wrote back to him and said, no, that we don't really have any additional information above, you know, the published statements. And that more or less remains true. Of course, now they've released all of the letters, and I can say that I did find one brief passing mention in one of those previously unreleased letters, so, but it doesn't change anything much. But the, Arthur goes on and he says, while I was searching through the files, I ran into a letter that my father, that would be Willie White, wrote sometime in 1930, it was either 34, 35, or 35, 36, sometime in, you know, there were 2 years, he wasn't sure exactly when it was, but he said, I think you might find my father's letter on the subject of the Omega of Apostasy interesting as well. And so he included that, he quoted Woolley's letter in the response back to Elder Pearson. And what Willie White, W.C. White, said was, I thought it was really intelligent because it happened to agree with what I'd thought. You ever notice how that is? It's like, all the really smart people think the same thing I do. But what he said was that, you know, when Ellen White made that comment about the Alpha and the Omega, you know, people immediately began trying to, you know, guess what the Omega is. And there had been, by the 1930s, well, he said, you know, probably a dozen different major ideas that had been floated around. Oh, this is the Omega of Apostasy. And Willie said that despite the fact that a lot of these people who advocated these ideas were good friends of his, none of them measured up in his mind. He said, I know that if you read just the wording of Ellen White's statements, the only thing you can specifically, explicitly link this Omega to is the Alpha, which is linked to something that could be contained in Living Temple. Okay? So if you go that route with it, then you're going to come up with really a fairly specific definition of some sort of mysticism. Okay? But Willie said, just more like from his gut level feeling of it, having lived through the experience and having known his mother during the time, he said that Kellogg's anti-establishment, anti-administrative activities, Kellogg really did a lot to try and tear down Daniels and others at the General Conference level. And he did a lot to try and tear down Ellen White after he became disaffected. and there was a lot of undercurrent, undercover antagonism to the General Conference and the leaders. And Willie just said, basically, I know that's all that I can explicitly link the wording of my mother's letters to, but in my mind, I can't imagine the Omega not containing this anti-organizational, anti-administrative type of sentiment. I thought that was quite interesting. To me, what's interesting is that so few people at the time realized it. Okay, Kellogg did not go around spouting anti-organizational slogans himself. He had his lieutenants do this. James T. Case was one. Charles, just happened to have his name right here on the back of my book. What was his name? Charles Stewart was another guy. These were doctors that Kellogg had helped train. They were loyal to him, and they would go around and do his dirty work for him, so to speak, often in a semi-plausibly deniable way. Tell you one story from that episode or that period in this regard. Ellen White was instructed to be ready to meet Kellogg's apostasy, but then to sit on it. There's a classic statement that I just read this last week. She says, "We must act, but we must wait." And she said, "There will come an explicit, obvious attack from Kellogg and his forces. And at that point, we must have our material ready to print, ready to distribute, but not before. They play their hand first. We must act, but we must wait." And so what happened, actually, is that Charles Stewart ended up writing a book. It started off as a long letter of attack and complaint to Ellen White, and then he later turned it into a book. And there are lots of, kind of your standard anti-spirit of prophecy arguments contained in that book. Just to help fix it in your memory, just kind of as a curiosity thing. Stewart was, he couldn't have been all bad because he was a cheap guy, and I'm a real cheap guy. When he wanted to get his book printed, he went down to the printer, and he said, "How much will it cost me to get this book printed?" And he was given some sort of a price. And he said, "That's a lot of money. Can't we cut that price down somehow?" And the printer is reputed to have said, "Well, yeah," he said, "I've got a bucket of ink over there that I got to get rid of. If you don't mind it being printed in blue, I'll use that ink and I'll take, so many dollars off the price." And so Stewart's book was printed with blue ink. Now, if you were a printer back in those days, that might be significant. It was a special blue ink. It was called Butter Wrapper Blue. And it was the only ink formulation that would not run when it was exposed to fat. Anybody remember Blue Bonnet margarine? Or Blue Bonnet butter, right? That's why, right? Because all the wrappers had to be printed with Butter Wrapper Blue or the ink would run. And so that's the color of Stewart's book. So his book came out in 1907, and it was the direct attack. And Ellen White and Willie White, Arthur Daniels and others, they were ready to act at that point. And so they did. But up until that time, Adventists generally did not yet perceive a great danger from Kellogg. Despite all the warnings and comments from the Spirit of Prophecy, there had been a lot that had gotten into print already. But despite that, the average Adventist was not seeing problems with Kellogg. It's like the whole argument with Lucifer in heaven. God couldn't kill Lucifer at that point because there would have been too many questions. People wouldn't have understood. And so Ellen White was told, "We must wait, or we must act, but we must wait." And I think that's an important thing to remember. I'll just leave that at that. That there's there are crisis moments at which we need to be ready to act and proceed. So anyhow, after that, people all began guessing what this omega of apostasy would be. And sometime in about the 1920s, an interesting conceptual shift occurred. I have some suspicions that I think it might have been Taylor Bunch, Elder Taylor Bunch, who first enunciated this idea. I'm not absolutely positive he was the first. But it was an interesting idea. The idea was that this is the alpha of apostasy over here, the beginning of the alphabet, and the omega is at the opposite extreme. And so the hypothesis became then that the alpha is pantheism, the idea of God in everything. The omega would be the opposite of that. That seemed a lot easier than to believe that Adventists would be attracted to pantheism. You know, we kind of been burned with pantheism. We weren't going there again. But you know, it's really hard to reason from a basis of opposites. Okay? So if I said, what's the opposite of salt? Some of you would say pepper, and some of you would say sugar, perhaps. You know? What's the opposite of a cat? Well, you might say a dog, but I would say it's a giraffe, because my giraffe is a lot taller than your little cat. You know? I mean, that's really the opposite. It's very difficult to reason conclusively on a basis of opposites. And so, this is what Willie White said, is all these ideas have come along, but none of them have included this anti-institutional, anti-church organizational attitude. I can't believe that any of that actually constitutes the omega. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I was describing to Paula at lunchtime, Paula and Jennifer, but a couple of years ago, just after we moved up to Canada, I got, the Lord tricked me into writing on, if you've seen my book, Tremble, that's what I'm talking about. It's not a topic that would have attracted me. It's not something I would have gone into. But this is writing about Kellogg and his pantheism and what it means potentially in our day. and this is not strictly from 1901, although 1901 was the turning point. You know, when Ellen White wrote and she said that the outcome of the last conference was the greatest, most terrible sorrow of my life, she was largely, maybe not exclusively, but she was largely referring to Kellogg. Because Kellogg just simply had not, his spirit of antagonism to the ministers and the officers had not been taken care of, when actually he'd been treated quite well in the 1901 reorganizational process. But anyhow, in the process of dealing with a manuscript that was given me and then eventually ended up writing my own book, there is something that there is a convergence of things that I'll have to say I find quite concerning, that is not commonly perceived. You have different people who might be concerned with one aspect or another aspect, but there is a centrality convergence point that most people don't understand or grasp. And for myself, I'm at a place where I would be willing to say, yes, I think we can, for the first time in history, look at something that is on our horizon right now and say it has the components of the omega of apostasy. Is it the omega? You know, I don't know. I mean, the omega means at the very end, right? And I would never want to underestimate the devil's ability to make things worse. So I'm not going to jump up and down and say it is the end, but it has the components. And let me just paint that picture for you briefly, because I think it, unfortunately, is going to be an important one. One other point, and that is that once the spirit of prophecy became more readily available, especially with the advent of the CD-ROM a few years back type of thing. It was much easier to do research on obscure thoughts and concepts, you know, being able to search and find a particular word. It became evident that this Alpha and Omega as opposites, there's no basis for that at all. It has as much solidity as the idea that the sanctuary represents the earth. It's an interesting concept, somebody thought up, it's plausible, but there's no support for it in the inspired writings whatsoever. And so instead of looking for opposites, what eventually people have realized is that we're looking at an acorn-oak tree relationship. If you remember, some of you would be old enough and whatnot to remember, in 1980, Lewis Walton wrote a book entitled Omega. Anybody remember that one? A couple hands? Okay. In 2002 or something like that, I forget, he wrote a book called Omega 2. Okay? It's interesting. The 1980 book uses the opposites perspective. The 2002 book, he had done some study somewhere along the line in between, and he ditched that. He was clearly, you know, acorn oak tree. We are looking at a reemergence of mysticism. We are looking at a reemergence of blatant spiritual power coming back, just as Kellogg was somehow dabbling in. Even as late as 2002, that probably would have struck most Adventists as fairly odd. You know, it just didn't seem like we were headed down that path. But there's been a lot of progress, development along those lines, and unfortunately, without going into all sorts of graphic details or one thing or another, yes, there are certainly individuals within our church who are advocating a much more mystical concept of relationship with God. Let me give you a convenient, simple, working definition for mysticism. Okay, people, yeah, it's kind of mystical. I don't know. It sounds like a bad thing, but I'm not sure what it is. Mysticism is simply the belief that human beings are in control, can choose to control a relationship of direct communication with God. Okay? Anything that says, here's this practice, Lectio Divina or centering prayer or other names I can't think of right now, walking the labyrinth, whatever it may be. If I engage in that practice, it allows me to stipulate, if you wish, the time and the occurrence for my direct communication with God. Okay, that's what mysticism is. And when I say direct communication, you know, the track of truth and error are always close together, right? We can certainly pray. We can certainly be open to the suggestions and the impressions of the Holy Spirit on our mind and heart, or however you want to anatomically divide that out. But this is different than that. This is direct communication. And give you one example that I cite in my book. And this is an example reported favorably, right, by a participant in an Adventist-sponsored course describing how she was walking the labyrinth. Are you familiar with... I hate to have to explain all this stuff because it's probably boring to you, but you know, the idea of a labyrinth. A labyrinth is not a maze. A maze, you have to try and find your way from here to there, you know, the little mouse is here and the little thing of cheese is over there, and you know, you have to do this. Okay. A labyrinth, there is no wrong way. A labyrinth is just a convoluted pathway, but there are no corners, there are no options. And the whole point is that you have absolutely no thought involved. You just follow the little trail, and it leaves your mind as empty as you can manage to make it. Okay? Yeah, so she described how at this Adventist-sponsored training program, she was walking the labyrinth, and she heard a series of communications from God, and each one consisted of two words. Let's see if I can remember them in order. There were apparently six regions of the labyrinth somehow, or maybe three on the way in and three on the way out. I don't remember exactly what, but at each predictable place, she received this voice from God, right? Okay. The six phrases were, I am, you are, they are, we are, everything is, I am. Now you just run that together a little bit, and what you have is pantheism. Just flat out pantheism. Okay. Ellen White wrote some interesting things. She said, we need not the mysticism contained in Living Temple. Those who are, I forget the wording, there's a verb, those who are practicing this or whatever it was. She says, if they go a little bit further, they will be in a position where God will be able to speak to them directly. It's not the exact wording. I could find it in a bit, but anyhow. Yeah, it should be in there. I don't know, this would be really boring to sit here and watch me thumb through the book and try and find it. it's what she's saying there is that if I just take that as more or less literal, she's saying that if Kellogg's followers and adherents were to go a little bit further, they would be into a full-blown mystical experience. Okay, I don't think that they were, most of them, maybe some. I don't think that they were. She also says, though, that this pantheistic stuff, when they once take the bait, it is almost impossible to recover them. It's very compelling. So let me tell you a different story. Back in 1987, I was writing an article on the Alpha and the Omega of apostasy. And that's when I came to the conclusion that we were really talking acorn-oak tree type of thing, not opposites. And so I was reading, and I didn't use this story in my article, and unfortunately I've not been able to find the story again to verify it. But because I had been in a situation that involved almost exactly each item step by step of this person's experience, I have no question as to my memory. This is one of the most vividly impressed things on my memory. The story comes from a female researcher who went to a convention in Atlanta, Georgia, big convention town. This was a convention of 5,000 some odd plus Luciferians. Now, you have to understand, Luciferians do not regard themselves as Satanists. They believe in Lucifer, who is the light giver, right? Lucifer's the good guy. Satan is nothing more than the bad public relations that those nasty Christians have dumped onto Lucifer. It's just a political smear job. That's all Satan is in their minds. And interestingly enough, the way they support that is they'll take people to Genesis chapter 3 and they'll say, okay, so read the story. Now, what did God say about the tree? If you eat it, you die. What did the snake say about the tree? It'll make you wise. And so they ate the tree. Did they die? So who's telling the truth? God or Lucifer? See, that's how they do that. Anyhow, so these Luciferians were gathered in Atlanta, and this researcher prepared a survey and circulated it around and, you know, got some percentage of responses back. The main question of interest on the survey was something along the lines of, there's a really good chance that you were not raised in a Luciferian home. So what was your first contact? Well, good question. It was something in the high 40s. I think it was like 46% all had the same answer. And the remaining 54% were scattered around at a bunch of different things. But this very large plurality, 40-some percent, all said the same thing. They said, my first contact was in a stress control seminar in my local Christian church. And I had been in a situation where a stress control seminarist had come to our local Adventist church and presented exactly what we'll describe next here. So the woman writing the book got all these responses, and incidentally, she was pro-Luciferian. Okay, this was not an expose. This is just a statement of the case. She said, 47%, 46%, whatever it was, all said the same thing. Answers varied a little bit, of course. I'll simply give one story here that's kind of archetypical. Everybody, you know, they would all identify with this. And this was the story of a former Baptist minister, probably in a small independent Baptist church. You know, who knows, maybe he was a truck driver during the week, but on Sunday he was the Baptist minister. You know, one of those type of situations. Along comes a seminarist, calls him up and says, Pastor, my name's Fred, and I travel around and I do Christian stress control seminars. Would you like me to do one in your church? I could squeeze one in on Tuesday night this next week. We don't charge anything. We just take up a love offering, you know. if you're a congregationalist pastor, could you imagine that, Pastor? Wouldn't that be kind of a really weird situation? Just you're all on your own, baby, you know? So along comes some guy who's going to do something in your church. Well, that seems like a good thing, right? So he said, oh, sure, come on out. So then he tells how it proceeded. The guy gets up and talks about different things and, you know, explains things and sort of won their confidence a little bit. And then he said, now, let me just walk you through a simple stress reduction exercise. So just lay down on the floor. Lay down on your back on the floor. Everybody lies down on the floor. And then you go, stress your right arm. Hold it for 20 seconds. You know, now relax. Just shake a little bit. Okay, left arm. Right leg, left leg, gut, face, everything all at once. For 20 seconds. You know, okay. Well, you know, physically, you've just exerted a considerable stress and a relaxation. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it always feels better when you stop hitting yourself on the head with a hammer. So you're lying there, you know, and feeling, you know, the immediate stress is gone, you know, and it's, I don't suppose there's anything evil up to that point, okay? But then the seminarist said, now, close your eyes. And just imagine that you're at the beach, down the ocean beach. Just kind of picture it. You're all by yourself. You can hear the seagulls flying overhead, wind, the waves. There's nobody else there. It's peaceful. It's calm. Look around. Feel the sun. Nice warm day. Just kind of picture that all as vividly as you can. So they're all picturing this little scene. There's a process called guided imagery, by the way. And then the seminarist says, now, look to the right, and way down the beach, you see someone walking towards you. And he's walking, you can see it's a man, and he's walking, and he's coming towards you, he's getting closer, and all of a sudden you realize this is Jesus. And he's walking, and he's smiling at you. Hi, Ray. And Jesus stands, Jesus is right in front of you. And Jesus says, what does Jesus say to you? And the Baptist minister wrote, what Jesus said to me was so obviously not a product of my own imagination, I knew immediately I was in touch with a higher spiritual power. That's how I became a Luciferian. This experience of contact with the universe is highly addictive. Once they take the bait, it's almost impossible to recover them. I believe that we have far more cause for application of that statement to our day than they ever did in Kellogg's day. Now, this is unpleasant. That's why I had to be tricked into this book. But I think it's important. I think it's important. Because it, like I say, there's convergence in some areas that I think are significant and dangerous. In the process of researching my book, I ran into an organization. It's called the Leadership Institute, TLI. It's in Orange, California, just out by Los Angeles. According to the information, I'm just going to go through this very quickly because I don't want to drag it out. But anyhow, apparently this organization was funded and founded at the direction of the Southeastern California Conference, the Seventh-day Adventist Executive Committee, in 1989. We know that it received significant funding. I don't know what that means, but that's the words used. Significant funding on a yearly basis from the Southeastern California Conference up until 2002, which is when a particular article was written that happened to mention that. Beyond that, I can't tell you if there's been any funding. This organization is the one that I mentioned before with the woman walking the labyrinth. Okay. This organization has a considerable. I mean, I've. How to say this delicately? The information is, it's really easy to get information these days on the internet. Okay? If you want to try something interesting sometime, look up Google search operators and play with the site search operator. Basically, it's a way to get Google to tell you everything it knows about any given website. All you do is you type in the domain name. So what are you here? You have threeangels.org? Okay. So go to Google. Type S-I-T-E colon, no space, threeangels.org. No, there is a space. Yeah, S-I-T-E colon space threeangels.org, and it will list everything that Google knows about that web page. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is that Google often knows things that you don't know how it knows and why it knows and how it ever got there, because it will find things that you didn't ever have a link to on your web page, but it knows that they're there somehow, apparently. Anyhow, being the snoopy guy that I am, I did that with the TLI website. I went through most of their curriculum materials, which were probably not intended for the public, but I just asked Google, and that's what he found. And these materials are blatantly teaching standard occultic techniques of mysticism, okay? Quote-unquote Christian mysticism, the Catholic tradition of Christian mysticism, the mystics who established this direct communication with God. One more quick example, Lectio Divina. Anybody familiar with that? Okay, yeah. See, this is unfortunate. Yeah, anyhow, we could avoid these things, but anyhow, Lectio Divina is probably as common as most any of the techniques that's used, and it's couched in a quote-unquote sort of a Catholic-style Christianity packaging, okay? So the way it works is I get up in the morning and I say, well, I should have my devotional time. Today, I think the Lord is impressing me to read something from the book of John. And so I go to the book of John and I just thumb back and forth and I ask, Lord, what are you impressing me to read today? And somehow, I'm manufacturing this, of course, but somehow today I'm drawn to chapter 3. And so I'll read through chapter 3, and then I say, Lord, what is there in chapter 3 that's of value to me today? And just to make it life real simple, we'll go with verse 16, since you all know that. And so then I'll read John 3:16 through maybe, you know, 5 times, 10 times, and I ask myself, what is there in John 3:16 that is calling out to me today? And maybe it's the word whosoever. So now I focus on the word whosoever, and I begin repeating that 100 times, 200 times, whosoever, 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 whosoever. Whosoever. You know, after about 50 or 60, I suppose, I don't know, my brain may peak out quickly, it becomes nothing. It's not a word anymore. It's just sound. In Hinduism, they call it a mantra. It's a deliberate technique to shut down your thinking function in your brain and open your mind for spiritual contact. So they're teaching these things. Now, who are they teaching them to? Well, in the last 20 years as of the end of 2013, so 23 years now, at the 20-year mark, they had provided their 2-year course of instruction to 125 Adventist pastors. Why would that be? I'm not thinking that's a good thing. What makes it a little more strange to me, and really, you know, quite offensive actually, I did a lot of searching. I went through every copy of the Pacific Union Record for the last 20-some years. I went through the Southeastern California Conference internal newsletter thingy that they just send out to the conference there. I don't know who all gets that. And in all of that, I found exactly one and only one reference to the Leadership Institute. And that was a sweet little article written by the staff at the summer camp. And they said, well, in June we do the blind camp, and then we have the teen camp, and then we have the tween camp, and whatever. And they're just listing off the different things they do. And 3 times a year we host the Leadership Institute in their in their program, which they run to minister to the spiritual life of so many of our pastors. Something like that. That's the only reference to it. Other than that, no one seems to know it exists. I don't find that open and above board. I find that very troublesome. Well, there are other ways you can find information, of course. TLI is a nonprofit corporation, which means they have to file 990 forms every year. That's all publicly available. That's easy to find on the internet. So I hunted those up. For the last 8 years, the 990 forms have listed a Sandy Roberts as one of the board members. Sandy's an interesting name. It's sort of a, what's the word I want? Androgynous name. It could be Alexander. It could be Alexandria. It could be Sandra. And in reality, it is Sandra, because the address listed for this board member is the Southeastern California Conference office. And Sandra Roberts is the president of the Southeastern California Conference. When she first started serving on the TLI board, she was, I don't know, secretary or some other position. I forget exactly what it was. She served on that board for 8 years. She really should know what they're doing there. I'm quite certain she does. Actually, she's enrolled in one of the courses. Among other things that showed up when I did that site search is, really it's good to lock down your websites, because I have lists of the last four classes, names, addresses, emails, phone numbers, things like that. I'm sure that wasn't intended to be publicly disseminated, but Sandra Roberts shows up on one of the lists there for the continuing generation, the ongoing involvement group. Sandra Roberts knows full well what the TLI group is doing. She certainly should, because if you do just a little bit of checking back on it, you find out that her doctoral thesis at Pepperdine University was on spiritual formation and the development of these kind of programs. She knows exactly what's going on. So now, here's an interesting thing, and I'm really not necessarily suggesting that Sandra Roberts is like the literal incarnation of the devil or something like that. I'm not trying to pick on her. I've never met her, and she's probably a really nice person and doesn't kick dogs. But that being said, she is at an interesting convergence point of mysticism and opposition to church authority. That's pretty much the recipe. Well, to be elected president anyhow. Yeah, I don't know about the ordination process. Yeah. Right. Now, yes. Yeah. Very progressive minded. I guess that's progress. Okay, well, anyhow, my basic point out of that is that the whole Kellogg, understanding the whole Kellogg situation, and 1901 was really the turning point for Kellogg in some ways. It was his turning point in relation to Ellen White. Let's put it that way. 1896, I would say, was his turning point in relation to the Adventist ministry, but he still held Ellen White in high regard, and basically, yes, he was straying, but he was not, he wasn't in blatant rebellion to Ellen White. But in 1901, things went downhill in that regard as well. And I think today we're reaping some of those results. Things a little tricky. These mystical ideas are unfortunately spreading around, and that's not the only place you'll see it. It's one of the most notable, but they are spreading around, and so there's, like I say, I don't like this. I really don't like this whole topic. But there's one encouraging statement that's good, because it's nice to have your bearings and know when your feet are solidly under you. And Ellen White writes, she says that when those who have been involved in the Lord's work for many years are taken in by these mystical teachings, she says it is no longer a subject to be treated with delicacy. It should alarm us as nothing else has. And so it is, I try not to be too much of an, off the rails alarmist. But this one actually is serious. It has the elements of the Omega in it. And that's not a comforting thing. For what it's worth, I think it's probably time for me to shut up again, right? Long past, they all say. Okay. You're very patient. Yes, ma'am. Oh. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, okay, this is going to be somewhat uninformed because I haven't followed every blow-by-blow of it, okay? But I will say this for the annual council. The question is, you know, do you remember William Miller's recognition there was a higher power and a lower power and there had to be a law that governed? You know? That's just common sense when you stop and boil it down. And the question is, what's the relationship between a union and the General Conference? You know? What's the relationship between a union or a division or a mission and the General Conference in session? Now I should back up just a little bit. I'm sure everyone's aware that there has been a lot of agitation on the... Does anybody know what's going on with these lights? That's... Yeah. That's it. Yeah. When they get bright, it means shut up. No. Okay. But yeah. There you go. That's it. Anyhow, okay, so yeah, everybody knows that there's been agitation on the subject of women's ordination. And it had been addressed at the General Conference level, you know, in session by the delegates on two previous occasions. And there were, you know, those who, in all sincerity and goodness of heart, I'm sure, wanted to bring the question to the General Conference again this last time around. But the Elder Wilson and others, they said, let's just not do this, you know, let's not go in dumb and cold turkey. Let's set up a committee. So they set up the Theology of TOSC. The Theology of Ordination Study Committee. That's what the SC was, yeah. Theology of Ordination Study Committee. It had to be the most fascinating committee ever formed by the Adventist Church. I don't know if you ever looked it over, but there were, there was a huge spectrum, all the way from your spectrum people, if that means anything to you, you know, Eugene Pruitt was on the committee. For crying out loud, you know, a guy who, you know, had one semester of college, right? But nonetheless, he's a spiritual thinker and has some influence. They put him on the committee. Don McIntosh was on the committee. There's lots of people on this committee. I hope I'm not technically misrepresenting anything. So, you know, I'm not the ultimate authority. So this is my best understanding of it, but. I won't swear that there's nothing amiss here. But they met, I think, four times or five times, something like that. And the last time, they knew there was going to be a vote taken. You know, they were serving in an advisory capacity. They had no authority, no legally elected authority or anything like that. But the study process went on and... I'll just have to toss in my two bits worth type of thing. You know, I'm a product of the 60s and 70s. And just from my personal background, if you asked me just on a casual basis, say, Dave, what do you think? Should we ordain women the same as men? My inclination would probably be, no, I don't care. No, some of them are nice. Go ahead. And that would have been my probable gut level response, okay? And it really hasn't been an issue that I've felt all animated on and wanted to get all heavily involved in. However, I maintain ties with some of your friends from this place, and some of them ask me to do things on occasion. So I was given a study, a paper by Davidson from the seminary? Richard Davidson, yeah. Richard Davidson, which I was told was the foundation bedrock theological argument in favor of a biblical base for women's ordination. And, you know, it's kind of intimidating. You get these high-powered intellectual types, you know, and it's like, you know, who am I to argue with the geniuses? And so I read through the paper, and the paper was pretty intimidating. I was actually asked to just, you know, double-check all the sources and find out who they were citing as authorities and things like that. But I got to looking at the paper itself. It's quite an odd paper. It's very not abstract. Anyhow, it's spacey. Let's put that way. Okay. It bases its whole argument on some linguistic analysis of verbs from Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Okay. That's the whole basic thing. And I wish I could do a good job of quickly summarizing this, but basically the argument is that Adam was the word Adam means man, okay? And the argument was that was, I'm trying to get this right, that Adam was named after the race, not the race was named after Adam. Well, that's kind of a weird, twisted type of a thing. At one point, Adam was the whole race before, you know, Eve made her appearance. So, you know, but he made a big point out of that. And then he took the verbs for to tend and to keep the garden. And he did this. I like to think the man's sincere. I don't know him. I'm not trying to attack him. But he did this weird thing. He said, if we look for those verbs as they are used in connection with the sanctuary service, we find da-da-da-da. Well, it turns out that those verbs are used in connection with everything under the sun. It's just they're very common verbs. So, but he says, well, we're only going to look at the ones in the sanctuary service. So basically he says, we're going to look for these two verbs in connection with the sanctuary service, and then we're going to analyze those passages. So we take two verbs that were applied to Adam and Eve and everybody else in the Old Testament, but we're only going to look at the sanctuary service, and we find here that these verbs, which were applied equally to Adam and Eve, are applied in the sanctuary service. And that was really the sales pitch, you know? Okay, yeah, we threw out 80% of the uses, or 90-some percent of the uses of the verbs, but when we limit it to those ones that deal with the sanctuary service, those very verbs that were applied to Adam and Eve are also applied in the sanctuary service. Therefore, Adam and Eve were both priests in the temple of the Garden of Eden. Well, that's really fascinating, I thought. But he didn't quote the verses. And I thought, that's a little funny. Why wouldn't he quote the verses? So I hunted up the verses. The verses were not actually about the priests. The verses were about the Levites. And one of the passages is the passage that says, if anybody, like the Levite, gets out of line and starts doing what the priest is supposed to do, you kill him. That's not a verse that I would want to necessarily quote for this gentleman's argument. Okay. Anyhow. Why did I go into all that? So anyhow, so this is the kind of stuff that's being discussed in this TOSC committee, okay? So finally, they get done with all the presentations, pro and con, and I guess they kept a good, happy attitude about it, and that's nice. They get to the last meeting, and they had a simple vote. Do you or do you not, well, let's make it simple, do you believe that the Bible teaches, authorizes, whatever, the ordination of women equally with men? yes or no. And they all voted. And the no vote was in the mid to upper 60s or something like that. So, you know, almost two-thirds of the group said, no, I don't see that that is the teaching of the Bible. Well, of course, those who were hoping that they would, you know, the motion would pass, they were disappointed, and the others were relieved or whatever. And everybody thought it was over, except there were two bright guys who know how committees work. You know, if you're going to influence a committee, spend a little time, learn a little parliamentary procedure. It won't hurt you. It's a good thing to know. Anyhow, these two guys pop up, Mr. Chairman, we have a motion to make. And they presented what came to be known as the third option, or the third way. And literally, their argument was essentially, the group has voted, the consensus or the majority do not believe that the Bible explicitly authorizes the ordination of women equally with men. However, we can see a parallel in this instance with that of the children of Israel when they asked for a king. God had not authorized them to have a king, but he did grant it because of the circumstances. Therefore, we think that it may be within the proper bounds to authorize individual administrative units of the church to make their own decision. We are not taking a stance saying, yes, the Bible teaches this, but we see within the permissive will of God the possibility that, you know, maybe this union or this conference or something or this division would feel that in their circumstances that it would be the proper thing to do. So, how many of you would vote for the third option? And that's the one that got the narrow majority. And so, I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, really? Really? Make us a king is the argument we're going to use? On what? It did not strike me as the line of reasoning that I wanted to follow, you know. Okay, so that having been said, TOSC ended up with a in-favor vote for this third option. And with all due respect, that doesn't do much to engender respect. You know, if you voted, no, that's not what the Bible teaches, but you'll go for this third option. I'm just scratching my head and I'm saying, man, whoa, you know, what have you been reading? Anyhow, but it was non-binding anyhow. So it went to the General Conference and it was voted down. Now I have to say that I think Elder Wilson did some things very, very wisely at the General Conference session. When that motion was voted down, there were plenty of conservative brethren and sisters who would have happily entertained an immediate motion at that point, you know, that we go on record that this issue is forever decided and it should not be admitted to discussion and vote at the General Conference again. You can make motions like that. Doesn't guarantee anything, but you can make those kind of motions. Elder Wilson didn't. It was well known that he was not in favor of the motion to ordain women. And yet, I think he was wise in not heavily leveraging his own influence or trying to railroad anything through. And he repeated that several times, from what I understand. I wasn't there, but he repeated it several times. He said, this is the only motion we are addressing. This is the only question we are addressing on this. It does not affect this or this or this. And he named things that it was well known that he was not in favor of. But he said, we're not voting on those things. They are already in place and in existence. Despite my dislike, he didn't say that, but you know, it was well known. He says, we're not voting on that. We're voting only on this. What I think I see him doing is simply saying, This is God's church. This is a general conference session. Either God's going to take care of it or he won't. There's no value in me trying to use human wisdom, human power. There's no value in me trying to railroad something through. It could be done. Sure, it's done all the time. But you know what it does? It just makes the other side really, really mad at you. And they will come back all the stronger, which is what's happened with our political discussion between the Democrats and the Republicans right now. You know, they're not really good terms with each other at this point. It's because everybody's using every dirty trick that they can, and it just makes the other side more disgusted and more antagonistic. And pretty soon, if history's any lesson book, somebody's going to end up with a knife in his back. You know? I mean, Brutus was Julius's best friend until he killed him. Just saying. Okay. Anyhow, so at the committee, or at the Autumn Council, I'm winding this off here. At the Autumn Council, the consideration was, what do we do with a union that is in defiance of the General Conference session? What do you do? And there was a variety of talk, and just to illustrate again how close this stuff comes to just this mutual sticking people in the eye, okay? The rumor went out that the General Conference was going to try and change the status of specifically the Pacific Union from union to mission. That's a predefined organizational condition or status, okay? A mission has a different relationship to the General Conference than does a union. The General Conference has much more authority over the officers of a mission than they do over a union. This is all defined in the working policies and all that sort of stuff. So the word went out, that's what they're going to do. They're going to try and demote us from union to mission so that they can control the whole operation out here. Well, immediately there were people, predictably, mad. You can't do that to us. And so at the union constituency session, a month and a half ago now, something like that, there were two motions that were bantied about. One of them was to change what's known as the dissolution clause in the Constitution for the union. Every nonprofit organization has to have a dissolution clause, okay, in the United States. Because nonprofits, they get money and they give out these tax-deductible receipts. And so the government says that money never goes outside of a nonprofit environment. So if your organization ceases to exist, you have to have a statement in your constitution that says that the assets, everything that your organization owns will be given to another nonprofit organization. It cannot go outside of those boundaries. And so they all the organizational entities of the church have a clause like that in their constitution. And the unions, typically, I don't know if there's any exceptions, I don't think so, the union's dissolution clause all say that if the Pacific Union for some reason should fold up shop, its assets would go to the General Conference. And so the motion out there this summer was, let's change that. Let's make it say, if the Pacific Union ever ceases to exist, its assets will be distributed proportionately to its constituency local conferences. What they were saying is, General Conference is never going to get control of us and our assets. Now, that motion did not come up and was not, they stopped short. There was one other one, too, and I don't remember what it was, but they stopped short of actually bringing that motion up or voting on it. And so at the Autumn Council, I think largely probably with Elder Wilson's input and advice, what they've done is initiated a one-year process of communication and hopeful reconciliation to avoid having a head-to-head clash with these insubordinate unions. I don't know what the odds are of success in that regard, but it's slow, it's measured, They can't accuse him of him. They can't accuse the General Conference of railroading anything. It's a very, transparent sort of a policy, and it remains to be seen what the union will respond. I'm not overly hopeful. I personally think that these folks are very determined, very, very determined, very disciplined. They stay on their message with unerring commitment. And so I don't think, if I were going to have to guess, it'd be a very pleasant miracle if there was an amicable settlement of the issue. But that's what I know of that happened. If there's anything else, somebody else can tell them, because I'm sure it's time for me to be quiet. I always get myself into that situation somehow. I will say, for whatever it's worth, I have some of these little pocketbooks that are provided to me free of charge. A donor paid to have them printed, and he wants them distributed out. So if you have an interest and don't have a copy, you're welcome to get some. I'll take them outside there. I do have a few books that if anybody wanted to buy a book, I could sell it to you at the lowest price known to the market. But I can't give those away. So anyhow, Pastor, you're a patient man.
Thank you, Dave. I know we ended on a rather somber note here dealing with current issues. But, when you're dealing with current events inside and outside the church, we're going to have a few somber thoughts about it, because things are happening. We are moving in a direction where trials are ahead, and the church will go through trials as well. But don't ever doubt that God has a way out for our church, and that His people will survive to the end. Now, there are a couple of books I'd like to share. I mean, you meant this book, Identical, as well as Modern Mysticism. They're on the back of the table out in the foyer. I would encourage you to take one per household until you see that everyone has gotten one, and then if there's some left, if you need another one for your family, take another one. And then, of course, we also have the books Tremble and the Sozo out there on the table. I know that I haven't read Tremble. I read the Sozo, and I know that some other people that read the Sozo started to tremble. So, anyway, they will be available out there in the foyer, and I assume Dave will be out there too to make sure that you get the book at the right price. And if you pick one up and forget to pay, then you will tremble. Okay, so let us round this off tonight. We are going to have a fire out there. It's pleasant outside. It's beautiful. It's much warmer than yesterday. And so if you want to be sitting around the fire, you're welcome. If you don't have a chair, we may, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but you may be able to take one of these chairs with you, but we have to bring them back. The chairs out in the fellowship hall. But, again, that's up to you. So let us pray at this time. Please stand with me as we pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, I'm thankful that even though there will be an omega apostasy, that you have given us every reason to know the difference between right and wrong, between being faithful and unfaithful. And I'm thankful for the information that we have received here today and tonight, for the careful discussion about the various issues that relate to what was talked about earlier today. And I pray, Father, that you will help each one of us to stand firmly on your word, that each one here will be faithful to the counsel that is given both in your word and in the spirit of prophecy, and that we will not waver. Help us, Father, not to throw out the old just because it is old, and try new things just because they're new. Help us to weigh everything according to your word. And help us to be ready for the day when Jesus comes, to be found faithful, to actually know you, and to have a close walk with you day by day. So be with each one of us. Protect us from evil influences, from demonic influences in this day and age. And help us to keep our mind's eye on you in every day, every moment. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.